How we get. About a month ago, we started going through the book of Habakkuk, an Old Testament book. It's written by a minor prophet. And understand this, Habakkuk lived at a time when the kingdom of Judah, he was in the kingdom, the southern kingdom, they just weren't doing well spiritually. And he was frustrated, he was discouraged with it, and he lodges a complaint against God. Because of that, God didn't seem to intervene. And let me just put a verse to show you that on the screen here. Look at how it reads here, those first couple of verses. Oh Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear? Or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? And why do you idly look at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. He complains. But God responds. And his response is this, is that he is going to raise up a group of people, the Chaldeans or the Babylonians, and they are going to sweep over the land and basically destroy Judah because of their rebellion. And Habakkuk hears that answer, and he goes, I'm not sure if I like that. See, he wasn't thrilled that God would actually raise up somebody more evil than the people of Judah to deal with Judah's sin. Look at how it reads in verse 1, verse 13. You who are pure eyes then see evil, cannot look at wrong. Why do you idly look at traitors and remain silent when the wicked, and this is the Babylonians here, swallows up the man more righteous than he? See, all of a sudden, for Habakkuk, the people of Judah were not nearly as bad as the Chaldeans who were going to crush the people of Judah. For him, sin and righteousness became a little bit relative. And it's actually one of the applications a couple weeks ago for us is that we have this uncanny ability to really look at some sins and rate them as really bad, and then other sins which maybe we're a part of, and we go, they're not so bad. But Habakkuk lodges the complaint. And look at chapter 2, verse 1. Look at the attitude. I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower, and look out to see what he will say to me, and I will answer concerning my complaint. See, he sits on this tower, and he waits for God to answer, and I just picture him kind of folding his arms and going, okay, God, give it to me. And God answers him, and this is where we got to dig in this morning. We got to look at God's response, really, to his second complaint. Now, I got to warn you, it is a little bit heavier, a little more complicated maybe than what we've used to at times. But I want to give you three questions that sift out as to the complaints that Habakkuk has directed toward God. And if you're taking sermon notes, the first one was this. Why is there evil in this world? See, why is there stuff going all around? And God, you're not doing anything. But the second one, God, what are you going to do about it? And that's really the force of those complaints. God, you got to act. But then there's the subtle one here, the third one. Well, how are we supposed to live? When there's evil all around us, when the Chaldeans are going to come in and destroy our land, what do we do? Now, we pause and go, are these questions relevant for us today as we live in 2014? And my response is, I really think they are. Now, let's jump into the text this morning. I'm going to put verses 2 and 3 up on the screen here from chapter 2. And I'm going to use the New Living just because it flows better. I understand this book is written in a prose and a type of poetry. So a literal translation is very kind of choppy, and it's sometimes difficult to translate it where it reads smoothly. But look at how it goes. Then the Lord said to me, write my answer plainly on tablets so that a runner can carry the correct message to others. This vision is for a future time. It describes the end. And it will be fulfilled. If it seems slow in coming, wait patiently, for it will surely take place. It will not be delayed. Now, I got to stop here a second, because he tells the prophet to write the message I'm about to give you on tablets. I don't know if you caught that. It doesn't say scrolls or parchment paper at this point. But understand this. What he's saying is that this is of utmost importance. And you go, why? Think back to the last time prophetic things, important things, were written on a tablet. It goes all the way back to Mount Sinai when Moses was given the Ten Commandments. So it's a point of emphasis here, is that this is very important. But another phrase there, they're not supposed to understand, it wasn't supposed to be about just Habakkuk. A runner can carry the correct message to others. See, God is giving a message, and it's to be made public. It's not just a private conversation anymore. He's supposed to take it and give it to the nation of Judah. Just like the tablets were given at Mount Sinai. But one more phrase to point out here in those first two verses. It says, this vision is for a future time. See, it describes an end, a point in the future that will be fulfilled. See, God was wanting to make these people aware that something in the future is going to take place. And it will be a culminating point when something big will happen and make it public. Now, let me just throw a scenario at you right now. What if I took some big cardboard or almost kind of plastic signs and I wrote this message on them? The world is coming to an end. Eternity will begin. God is working. Repent. The final event is about to happen. And I take them down to 169 and Highway 2 there, right at the main corner. And I start walking around and holding those signs up at that corner. Now, if I had sign-ups here after the service, how many are willing to come and do that? See, the challenge is at times we see that and we kind of go, oh, they're just making a spectacle of themselves. And the reality is that there is a point of time where history is going to come to a conclusion, where judgment's going to take place. And do we recognize that? That eternity is going to begin. See, that's the truth of it. And understand this, is that scholars actually believe that this text in chapter 2 here is not just for their day. It actually is for us and even beyond, pointing there's an eschatology a part to it. That it's really for the future, and it's speaking to something even for us. That applies. I think of that day, there will be a day coming, folks, where we're going to be ushered into the presence of God. And he goes, my children, come with me. And others, he will go, I never knew you. You think of Matthew chapter 7, where Jesus pointed that out. But see, there's an end times component to it. But the question, what is God trying to communicate to Habakkuk here? And to these people. So fundamentally, as we approach these next few verses, understand this. This is a lesson that he's given to Habakkuk that's talking about a battle between good and evil, between God and Satan at this point. And he's wanting these people to understand what's going to happen and how they're going to have to live in the context of it. Now, here's one of the challenges, for me at least personally. This is a personal opinion and even kind of a frustration. We rarely struggle with deep questions about evil, where it comes from, the nature of evil, the nature of sin, who gets to decide what it is. We just don't wrestle with that stuff anymore. I remember the first philosophy class I had my freshman year, and I think it was the fall of 1973. I get in there, and we're starting to wrestle with good and evil, and my teacher was a Presbyterian minister who had become an atheist. And he shot us down, and I had no tools how to challenge, how to give a perspective of the gospel in the class. So are we understanding that the nature of evil is so important? I heard a quote this last week, and it said this, that the evangelical church is living and acting like an Acts 2 church rather than an Acts 17 church, which we are currently in. Now, if you don't know the difference, Acts chapter 2 is where Peter comes and he preaches to the crowds in Jerusalem. And people were getting saved left and right. But understand this, the dynamic at that point in Acts 2 is that people believed in God, believed in Yahweh. And the gospel was easier at that point. Acts chapter 17 is where Paul goes to Greece. And he's in Athens, and he has to go and debate the Stoic philosophers of the day. And the way he had to present the gospel was different there than the way the apostles approached it in Acts chapter 2. And we are living in a world where we're much closer to Acts chapter 17 than we are to Acts chapter 2. But let me just take a little bit of a pathway here and go down an alley here for a few minutes. And I want to just kind of give you an overview of an ethics or kind of a philosophy lesson in to help us realize how people determine what is good and what is evil. And realize that there's fundamentally three approaches to this question of how do you determine what is evil. And I believe that we need to be able to speak to these things in our day if we're going to challenge people about the issue of who God is. Now, you've heard me say this before many times, that people claim the right to determine what is good and what is evil. But catch this, it's based on two questions. And the first one, if you're taking notes, I said it this way. It's the question is, they believe this. What is the most loving thing to do? Let me try to illustrate this. For abortion, why would you want to bring a child into this world if there's poverty? Why would you want a child to grow up in a home if it's a home where there's alcohol and drugs and all kinds of things? Isn't it more loving not to have that child come in the world? See, that's fundamentally the question. What's the most loving thing to do there? Matter of fact, the whole issue of gay marriage, how can you keep two people from loving each other? Isn't it more loving to give in to that and to go down this path? That's the foundation of many of the arguments of today. What is the most loving thing to do? But there's a second question here I got to give you as well that people use. And it's this, what is the reasonable thing to do? See, doesn't it sound reasonable that you have a right to do with your body whatever you want to do? Doesn't that make sense? Think of it this way, for abortion. Think of the financial strain if we brought all of these babies into the world and the taxes and all of the things with it. See, we can reason our way out of it and go, this is the reasonable thing to do. The problem, who gets the right to decide what is loving, and what is the reasonable thing to do? And I know, how do we do it? Let's vote on it. Or whoever's in control, or whoever has power, decides what's loving and what's reasonable. You see the dilemma there. Well, folks, I submit to you, there's a third way to define what is morally good or morally evil. Number three, I described it this way, if you're taking notes. That truth is prescriptive. It's a prescription. Here it is, like a doctor writes a prescription. And it comes from someone or something that is transcendent. And it's obviously God. What we're saying this is that truth, what is true, does not originate with man, but it comes from God who is out there who defines what is most loving, and he defines what is the reasonable thing to do. He has the right to determine that. See, the question, can we speak to those things and challenge people as to the basis of how they're deciding what is good and evil? And I believe we can. And we must, especially if the gospel is going to make sense. If there's ever going to be an absolute issue of good or evil. Because if everything is relative, at that point, nothing matters. And chaos exists through this universe. Enough for my ethics lesson here. Let's move on. Let me just dig into these next few verses and show you this lesson, kind of dig a little bit and just realize that the God is trying to teach him a lesson about this battle of good and evil. But first, I want you to, as we read this, notice the pronouns. Behold, in verse 4, his soul is puffed up. It's not right within him, but the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor, an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol, like the death he has never enough. He gathers for himself all nations and collects as his own peoples. Woe to the Chaldeans! Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is his own? For how long? The load himself with pledges. Now, I understand one of the issues that he's teaching Habakkuk centers around the evilness of greed. Okay, and we'll see that more in a moment here. But this lesson is that this somebody is recruiting nations to follow him. And woe to this person that uses people for greed. Now the question, is God talking about here the Chaldeans? Or is he talking about the people of Judah? Or something else? And the answer to that question is yes. He's actually talking about all three, but that third one is really the key here. Because what he's really defining is that who leads the Chaldeans? Who is causing the rebellion? Where does rebellion come from in the people of Judah? It starts with Satan. And Satan is wanting to lead people away from God. And there is a battle of good and evil that he's teaching them about. And how we're going to have to, and how Judah's going to have to deal with that battle. But look at verse 7 and 8 again. But you'll note, by the way, you'll notice here when you read this that it changes from he and him to you and your, if you have a literal translation here. Look at verse 7. Will your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Now, who's God talking? Just stop there a second. God is speaking to a group of people here. And it's probably those that are the righteous people in the midst of the battle. Okay? Then you, those who are righteous, will be spoil for them. Who is them? The wicked people. So the righteous are going to be a spoil for the wicked people. And what's he doing there? He's warning them that you're probably going to suffer in the midst of this battle. But look at verse 8. Because you... I think he's speaking collectively now to Judah, have plundered many nations, and all the remnant of all the people shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. You see, he's describing some of the tensions of this battle between good and evil. But look at verse 9. There's a hint, well, more than a hint, as to who really is in control. Look at verse 9. Woe to him. who gets evil gain for his house, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm. See, somebody is ultimately in charge. Why? Because they have the power to go, "Woe, woe is you." They're going to stop it, folks. Its judgment is coming. But look at verse 10 here. Again, he goes, comes back to evil. "You have devised shame for your house by cutting off many people. You have forfeited your life." You see, he returns to the talking about people, greedy people. It's defining wider, in one sense, what's really happening in this battle. Now, and here's the challenge for us. We tend to pick and choose that which is really evil, even in our culture today. For example, we focus in the last year or two over so much on the issue of homosexuality and its sinfulness. And it is sin. There's no doubt about it. But understand that God is calling here, he's calling out the issue of greed. And I don't know if you're aware of this, is that the New Testament speaks out far more against greed than it does homosexuality. But see, it's easy for us to kind of minimize that. See, this text points to people are using sin for self-advancement, for security. And God hates greed. Greed uses people to get up the ladder. Selfishness rules where people are on top and they use the people underneath them to get to the top. And they create caste systems and important people and cool people and those that are to serve them. Now, I don't know if you realize this issue of greed, just how important it is and how evil it really is. In Colossians chapter 3, he lists a bunch of sins and he says, "And greed, which is idolatry." It equates greed with an idol, serving and worshiping idols. But the nature of evil, he's describing how there's this tension in our world of people. Look at verse 11 and 12 to move on. "For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity." Woe, judgment is coming to those people. Now, for the sake of time, I'm going to jump down to verse 18. We just don't have enough time to walk through all of the pictures of it. "But what profit is an idol when its maker has changed it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, 'Awake,' to a silent stone, 'Arise.' Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all." I think it's describing it this way. Is woe to him who's building a life focused on possessions where they become their idols. Woe to those people. But yes, it speaks to Babylonians that are going to be a part of the woe. There's going to be judgment on them as they swallow up the nations. Judah is going to feel the wrath of God with that woe as Chaldeans come over and overrun them. But the bigger picture really is about the battle between God and Satan in this cosmic battle that's taken place. And I think the challenge as I was pondering this, do we see the bigger battle? Do we remember it, that it's going on around us? See, are we naive enough to think that this world is just about electing the right officials to bring America back to its roots? Folks, in 1776, there was a cosmic battle taking place back then. We're just not aware of it. We don't think of it in those terms. You go back a number of thousands of years to the time of Habakkuk. There was a battle going on between good and evil. Are we aware of that? Let me put Ephesians 6 as a reminder on the screen. Look at how it goes. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness. There's a present darkness right now, against spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. Parents, are we parenting our children knowing that a cosmic battle is going on? Are we articulating that to our kids? Are we able to explain it to people that God is bringing into our lives? Are we preparing our children, parents, and you that have younger kids, you're going to face this even more. Are you preparing for your kids to suffer? Because I think in the next, if it goes the same rate that we're going now, just wait 10 years and where it will be at. But as adults, are we prepared to figure out how we're going to live in a world where the evil and the good are going to become more and more intense? And no, the answer isn't moving deeper into the woods to get off the grid. That's not the answer. But think of those, back to those first two questions. Why is there evil in this world? Can we explain to people that Satan tempted and convinced Adam and Eve that autonomy and living without God was reasonable and in their best interests? So they broke relationally with God and they decided to make up the rules of life, just like the leaders of Judah did, just like the Chaldeans did, just like people do in 2014. See, people today continue to believe that life apart from the Creator is reasonable and it's good and it's great. But it leads to that second question. God, what are you doing about it? And we have to come back to this text. And part of the answer is, woe, a day is coming. But to get to that day, at least from Habakkuk's perspective, that God had to raise up a nation where a Jewish woman would give birth to the Son of God, and that where he would have to pay the penalty of sin to cover and to give pardon to people from the woe. You catch that? And he offers life to those who are willing to seek him and his kingdom. But in the meantime, till that woe is fulfilled, till we get to that point of eternity where God says, stop it, it's over, how do we then live? See, that's the fundamental question, even at the time of Habakkuk. And for your notes, how are we supposed to live when evil exists all around us? The answer is to live by faith. Now, I don't know if you realize this, if you caught it, but that answer was already given in the text today. Look at verse 4. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him, but evil is going all around, but the righteous shall live by his faith. It was given. There's evil in this world. Live by faith. Let me give you a passage in the New Testament that actually describes the battle with good and evil. In Romans chapter 1, there's this impressive writing of Paul. Look how I'll just pick a few verses here. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven, this battle against ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God and give thanks to him, but they became futile in their thinking and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and they exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man and birds and animals and creeping things. Therefore, God gave them up to the lusts of their hearts, to impurity, to this dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. See, this is a cosmic war that Paul is describing. People have exchanged they've thrown away the truth, living and believing the lie that they can serve themselves, and they can suppress the truth of the gospel. They can make up rules of morality. They can ignore God. And what do we do? I don't know if you realize it, that Paul had already answered the question. Look at verse 16. For I'm not ashamed of the gospel, the good news of Jesus, for it's the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For in it is the righteousness of God is revealed from faith for faith, as it is written. Look at the phrase. The righteous shall live by faith. Paul quotes Habakkuk. He's saying there's evil all around us. There's a battle going on. People are throwing away the truth. But the righteous must live by faith. Let me just real quickly give you Galatians 3, verse 11. He quotes it again. Now it's evident that no one can be justified before God by the law. But there's the side, the righteous shall live by faith. It's assumed there by Paul. But look at Hebrews 10 to close here, 37 and 38. It's very pointed. But recall the former days when you were enlightened. You endured a hard struggle with sufferings, sometimes being publicly exposed to reproach and affliction, and sometimes being partners with those so treated. For you have need of endurance. Don't we need that as well? So that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised. For yet a little while, and the coming one will come. Jesus is going to come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith. So some suspect Barnabas wrote this. They don't really know who the writer is. But he quotes Habakkuk chapter 2, that also to endure when suffering is around us, what's the answer? We're called to live by faith. See, that was for the time of Paul. It was for the time of Habakkuk a few thousand years ago. But fast forward to 2014. Folks, we have to figure out what it means to live by faith. In a world where there's a battle going on, the call is to live by faith. We don't have time to unpack that today unless you want to stick around for a couple hours. But let's just stand and pray, and we'll stop there.